worse. He had always believed in lucidity, in looking as clearly as possible at what was, despite the desire to veer off into comforting illusion and projection, and to follow the results rationally. So he couldn't protect himself now from the questions that followed. What did it signify to be reborn only to relive the previous life's anguish? What was the sense in that? What was the meaning? He could see, suddenly and for the first time, the appeal of escape, of nihilism. And yet some part of him, even then, the scientist in him, held him together, speaking clearly and steadily under the cacophony of blame and grief. Could the suicidal urge pour like a phobia or a personality characteristic from one life to the next? Could there be grief so unresolved and potent that it continued on, flowed into the next life as powerfully as a birth defect or a birthmark, where still it could not be shaken? He was not a praying man. Not at all, never. But he said a prayer anyway, standing on the bank of the river he couldn't bring himself to look at, that her next life would be far from here. He had pulled himself out of his despair only with brute will. He had gone cold turkey on the long train ride back to Calcutta, the craving pecking at his nerves, hands trembling in evidence of an addiction he had only dimly realized. When he emerged at last, shaken and sober, he had known that there were questions he couldn't ask himself, that there were attachments he couldn't make. It was the only way to continue, and he had continued in this way, steadily working, until now. In the motel minibar there were more tiny bottles, a whole row of them. Anderson turned the key and opened the door again and stared. It seemed only days earlier that he had stopped drinking. Not decades. Oblivion had been waiting patiently for him all these years. All right then, he thought. He reached for another little vodka. No. He ran to the bathroom and spat and washed his mouth out, brushing his teeth twice. Not that way. Not after all this time. He threw the key to the fridge in the toilet and flushed, but it remained in the basin, glinting like treasure at the bottom of the sea. He made his way back to the bed, and stretched his body out, trying to revive the feeling of warmth the vodka had generated under his skin. He could taste the alcohol on his lips, under the crest. On the other side of the wall, the boy was still sobbing. Damn. He liked him, the boy. Noah. Damn. 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 When Anderson dozed off at last, he dreamed of Owen. He dreamed that his son was whole. Owen was whole, and Sheila was happy, and there was no need to go to Thailand, no matter what Angsley had said on the telephone. He could stay in Connecticut with his family and his lab rats. He awoke suddenly to a feeling of loss so pure that at first he couldn't speak. He sat up in bed. The room was still dark. His mind was clear. I can help him. He thought, I can help this child. I got it wrong, but it's not too late to change that. So we had the wrong previous personality. Okay, that's happened before. I have the information I need now. I'll convince his mother. For Noah, I'll get it right. But he had given up, hadn't he? He got up and opened the blinds, looking out the window at the dawn beginning to assert itself across the indifferent parking lot, pale light illuminating the street. Another day, whether anyone liked it or not. Yet he felt himself, despite all his apprehensions, hungry to begin it. He walked over to his computer and turned it on. He could hardly wait for it to boot up. He opened the search window and typed in, Tommy, Asheville Road.
Chapter 20. Janie buckled in Noah and then herself, with a feeling of grim determination. In the event of a change in cabin pressure, the flight attendant on the video was saying, you put your oxygen mask on first, pulling the cord, and then you help the others in your party who needed your assistance. The video showed a nice-looking dad tugging the oxygen mask over his own face his placid daughter sitting quietly beside him, breathing bad air. What kind of idiot came up with that rule? They didn't understand human nature at all. She imagined the compartment filling slowly with smoke, and Noah beside her, gasping. Do they really think that she could straighten the mask on her own face and breathe in clean air while her asthmatic son struggled to take a breath? The assumption was that she and her child were two entities with separate hearts and lungs and minds. They didn't realize that when your child was gasping for air, you felt your own breath trapped in your chest. And meanwhile, she was lying to her own son. And this was making him howl in distress, disturbing the other passengers on the plane, disrupting their ability to hear how to fasten a seatbelt, and seriously addling her already compromised good sense. Noah wanted to go to Asheville Road, and they were going to Asheville Road, but he couldn't know that, not yet, not this time. Brooklyn, by way of Dayton, that's what she'd said to him. Grateful that he was still too young to make sense of a map. She was not about to make the same mistake twice. She'd make the new mistake instead, if need be.
I want to see my mama!
Noah was yelling. And the other passengers looked at her as if she were lying to them, too. The plane readied itself for takeoff and began wheeling forward, barreling down its runway. She had never been afraid of flying. But now she felt something like alarm at the plane's initial tremors as it rose. When she was pregnant, she'd read studies that high levels of the stress hormone cortisol could cross through the placenta and into the fetus, affecting fetal development and causing low birth weight. This made sense to her. It wasn't just the carrots she ate, the vitamins she took. What she felt, her baby felt. She had tried to remain as calm as possible, turning down a plum job with a big corporate firm so as not to adversely impact her developing baby with long hours and maximum stress. Now, she felt the cortisol spiking through her system and wondered if Noah could still somehow feel it, if tiny particles of her stress surrounded the air he breathed and made everything worse. She couldn't help it, though. The world was more dangerous than it had been a few weeks ago. It was a world that slipped and slid beneath you, where children died because mothers forgot to check the latch. How did you keep your child safe in that kind of a world? From the moment she'd stepped on the Greyhound bus until the moment she'd walked onto the plane with Noah and Jerry at Dulles Airport, she'd had the feeling of rolling down a steep hill. She couldn't stop. If she put her hands out on either side to slow the momentum, they would scrape themselves raw. The plane lifted into the sky. Noah's voice rose to a high, keening wail. And she was left with herself. What was she doing? How could she revisit this idea after the fiasco they had so recently encountered? How could she risk hurting yet another mother? How could she imagine that Noah was not hers, and hers alone? And yet, as if in response, the line came suddenly into her head. Your children are not your children. Where had she heard that? Who had said it? Janie leaned her head briefly against the seat in front of her and patted her shrieking son's knee. Your children are not your children. She remembered now, as she listened to the cries overtaking her in waves of sound and saw the flight attendant frowning down the aisle in her direction. It was a song, a Sweet Honey in the Rock song she'd heard with Noah last summer at a free concert in Prospect Park. It was an early July evening, the air mild and breezy. She had settled on a blanket with some friends and enough hummus and pita and carrots to feed a small city of preschoolers. The singers' voices had blended in perfect a cappella harmony. Your children are not your children. Though they are with you, they belong not to you. And Janie had taken off her shoes and wriggled her weary toes, listening to her friends' worries, private versus public schools, thoughtless husbands. She herself couldn't afford private school and had no husband to complain of, but she was happy because the song was wrong. And Noah was hers, and it was a beautiful evening, and she couldn't imagine having much love left inside of her for anybody else anyway. How could she have imagined, then, that she would be here, barreling faster than breath toward a woman who was not expecting them? Only last summer, and yet it may as well have been another life.
I want my mama!
Noah shouted again, and the whole plane could hear him, as if she were kidnapping him, as if he hadn't always been entirely hers. When the plane was safely aloft, and Noah had finally exhausted himself, crashing into a fitful sleep, Janie reached under the seat in front of her and pulled out the pages that Anderson had printed out the night before. Copies of newspaper articles from the Millerton Journal and Dayton Daily News about Tommy Crawford, who lived on Asheville Road and was 9 when he'd gone missing. He was a student at McKinley Elementary, where his mother was a schoolteacher. The photograph in the newspaper article was from school picture day. American flag on one side, cheesy rainbow backdrop against a fake blue sky. You could almost hear the photographer urging, "Smile wide now, smile big." Could be any boy, really. His skin was a light brown. He was African American. She didn't know why this should be surprising to her. He grinned up at her. He had a nice smile. Authorities call off search for missing boy. The Greene County Police Force called off the search today for Tommy Crawford, 9, of 81 Asheville Road, who disappeared from his Oak Heights neighborhood on June 14th. Though the child is feared to be dead, Detective James Ludden, who had been leading the search effort, stated that, "As far as I'm concerned, this case isn't over until we find the boy, one way or another." Crawford, who attended McKinley Elementary School, is by all accounts a bright and popular boy. His parents describe a cheerful child who loves baseball and is a devoted older brother to Charles, 8. Charlie misses his big brother, his parents, Denise and Henry Crawford, said in a statement. "We miss our beloved boy. If you have Tommy with you or know where he is, please, please call." She looked away. There was too much pain in this piece of paper. They were in the clouds now, on their way to a place she'd never been. She was flying on instinct, a mystery even to herself. Janie believed in consistency. It was something she took pride in. She said no crackers before bedtime, and then she stuck with it. She had been even-tempered, mostly. She had been constant, as much as possible. Kids needed that. She had tried to create order in Noah's life, the way her mother had created order in her own, after the chaos of living with her father. She didn't remember much of the time before her father had left them. There was a memory of sitting high up on his shoulders at the state fair. But was that a real memory or something she made up from a picture she had? There was the time the two of them went to the mall on some errand, and he had spontaneously bought a huge stuffed polar bear for her, far too big for any room but the living room. And her mother had objected, but then laughed and let her keep it there beside the TV. There was the smell of his pipe and his scotch, and the sound of him banging on the door all night long when he drank, and her mother wouldn't let him in. There was her mother holding a water glass filled with red wine, the first and only time Janie had seen her drink, telling her in the matter-of-fact voice she always had, that she had asked him to leave and he wasn't ever coming back. And she was right. He didn't. Janie was 10 then. She remembered that day perfectly, the startling sight of her mother drinking in the afternoon, the way the wine had splashed as her mother talked, and Janie had been nervous it would spill over. After that, her mother had gone back to work as a nurse, and they got into a regular rhythm. She started working nights when Janie was 13, but she was home to oversee schoolwork and always made sure there were healthful dinners in the house for her to warm in the microwave and clean pressed clothes for her to put on in the morning before school. And when those nights got a little lonely, Janie retreated to her room, where everything was exactly the way she wanted it to be. She opened the door and saw her framed posters of foggy European castles and horses, her furniture hand-painted in cheerful primary colors, her closets organized by color scheme, her color-coded world. A lifetime of creating orderly spaces had followed. And what good had it done when the world was not orderly? Even her mother had been, in the end, a mystery to her. When she had gone through her mother's house that week after her death, those days when she was hardly conscious, her heart frozen over with grief, the words fought their way occasionally to the surface and cracked through, words like why and orphan, though as far as she knew her father was still alive somewhere, and God, whom she had never been taught to believe in, but was furious at all the same. She'd found in the drawer of her mother's bedside table the kind of book her mom had always made fun of. It even had a rainbow on its cover and a New Agey title, You Can Change Your Life. She flipped through the pages. It had chapters on meditation, karma, and reincarnation, ideas her atheistic mother had never seemed to give a second's thought. She'd roll her eyes and say, Who has time to think about that? When you're gone, you're gone. Yet the book was well-thumbed and heavily underlined, with passages marked with stars and exclamation points. One sentence, Everything is a projection of mind, had three stars next to it. Had her mother wanted so desperately to keep life going that she'd lost her common sense? Or had she found something at the very end that changed the way she looked at everything? Or was it someone else's book, someone else's stars? Janie didn't know. And she would never know. So, she'd put it out of her mind, permanently. Or so she thought. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio. That was one of the things her mother had loved to say. She was a practical woman who worked all day with surgical instruments, but she had always had a soft spot for Shakespeare. Janie had never thought much about the quote. It was something her mother said, usually with a huff of impatience, in moments when she was out of explanations. Why her father had never called her, for instance, or in the hospital why she had refused to embark on yet another experimental treatment. The last time Janie had thought of it was the night in Trinidad, when Noah had been conceived. That night, after Jeff had left, she couldn't sleep, so she'd walked by herself back to the beach. It was late, and she was conscious, as always, of her vulnerability, a woman alone. The vulnerability heightened by the nearness of sex, of being seen at one's most unguarded. That raw moment of closeness with Jeff had been there. She had been in it. And now it was gone, like a lit match flickering out in the humid darkness. She looked at the sky, which made a mockery of the night skies she had mostly known. This was the essence of sky, in its depths of darkness and of light. Its beauty, like a piece of music, stirred her loneliness into something beyond itself, made her look up and out instead of in. She had a message in a bottle impulse to hurl her confusion out into the expanse in the hopes that something, God, her mother, might be out there, listening. Hello? She'd called out half-comically. Anyone there? She knew she'd have no answer. And yet, standing by the shore, the waves peeling back to expose the gleaming nakedness of sand pocked here and there with shells and stones, and then pushing forward, drawing their eternal curtain over the rawness, a feeling of peace had washed through her. She'd felt something was there. Was it God? Was it her mother? There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, she thought. It had been Noah, Noah was her answer. The thing that was there. That had been enough for her. So it was fitting, she thought, looking out now at a vast expanse of blue sky, that Noah would bring her right back here, to the most abstract of questions, which were now unbearably relevant. For either reincarnation was bunk, or it wasn't. Either Noah was sick, or he wasn't. And there was no way to know. There was no way to reason through it, or at least no way she knew or could imagine. Despite everything she knew or didn't know about living, despite the thousands of carefully analyzed, inexplicable cases, despite her moments of panic and her years of good sense, she would have to take a leap.
Chapter 21. You're too serious for the beach, she was saying. She was laughing at him.
Excuse me, sir?
It wasn't Sheila. It was the flight attendant, hovering over Anderson, offering him water and pretzels. He shook himself awake and took the tiny bag but refused the beverage, even though he was parched, afraid to jostle the sleeping child next to him by putting down his tray. The boy's mother sat beside her son, looking out the window. What was her name? It had fallen down the chute. It was gone. His mind felt as clear as ever. It was simply the word that eluded him. It was there, right in front of him, taunting him. And yet his brain balked, refusing utterly to reach out even a finger to touch it. He felt like Tantalus, parched and hungry, striving fruitlessly for the cool water and the grapes that were always just out of reach. Tantalus. Punished by the gods for telling humans their immortal secrets. Tantalus had high hopes for humans, and where did that leave him? Doomed, that's where. Banished to Tartarus. And how was it that he could remember the name and the story of Tantalus, but not the name he needed? Ah, the brain. Who knew why it remembered what it remembered, or lost what it lost? And here he was, Jerome Anderson, in Tartarus. The deepest region of hell. Things were falling apart rapidly. The woman's name was in his folder, of course, on the yellow pad in his briefcase, which lay at his feet. He could bend down right now and retrieve it. This particular bit of information could be attained. Yet who knew when he would lose it again, or what else he would lose? He shouldn't be here at all, especially since the case was not proceeding according to protocol. Perhaps he should stop. The boy would forget, eventually, but Anderson didn't know how. He was the man who didn't stop, that's what he was, all he knew how to be, from the moment he had returned home from his first cases with Angsley in Thailand. He had walked in the door 2 months later, electrified. Sheila was waiting for him on the couch, her strong legs curled up beneath her. She looked the same, that moon face as fine as ever. With its sprinkling of freckles across the nose, that heavy cloud of blonde hair. He, on the other hand, was a different man. She looked at him with a piercing, assessing gaze. He hadn't written her those 2 months except to cable her when he was coming home, and he was struck with tenderness for all of it. The old red couch with its stuffing showing at the seams, and the young wife who was trying to figure out if she still had a husband. The concreteness and sheer flair that constituted life as you were living it, the vibrancy of the illusion. Before he kissed her or took off his jacket, he was taking his files from his briefcase and laying them out on the coffee table. The photographs weren't pretty, but he wanted her to see. He spread them before her, the dead and the living, the deformities and birthmarks and the coroner's reports of the previous personality's death wounds. The girl with deformed fingers on one hand, the woman who had been killed when she had burned the rice. When he had finished with the last brutal and improbable detail, he looked at Sheila and drew in his breath, wondering what she'd say. He felt his whole life, his whole marriage, the only thing aside from his work that had ever meant anything to him, hanging in the balance.
"You certainly did surprise me, Jerry," she said.
She looked baffled and shocked and amused all at once. There it was, the thing he loved most in her, right there. That shadow of amusement that this was how her life was turning out. For a moment there when you walked in, I thought you were going to tell me you found another woman. This is what I want to do with my life. I want to go back, interview them all again in a year or two, find more cases.
You know that people are going to give you a hard time about this, that nobody's going to take you seriously.
I don't care about what other people think. I only care what you think. This wasn't, as it turned out, entirely true.
You're giving up a very promising career.
I'll make it work somehow. For us, he added, the word dangling awkwardly between them. So, what do you think? She paused and he held his breath so long he felt lightheaded from lack of oxygen.
I don't know, Jerry. How can I know? What you're telling me.
She shook her head.
How can it be possible?
But you see the data. I've shown it to you. What other explanation can there be? You think they're lying? But what reason would they have to lie? These families aren't getting any money from this. They're not looking for attention, believe me. And yes, it's possible that these kids have some kind of super ESP, I've thought of that, but these kids aren't just talking about other people's lives. They're saying they are these other people. And if you rule that out, I mean, what other explanation is there? And the birthmarks, the deformities, the way they match up to the modes of death, not always perfectly, no, but there is a connection, a visible connection, and I've only just started. There are too many instances for it to be random. It can't be random.
This is about Owen, isn't it?
For the first time, he stopped talking. She always saw right through him. She pored, perplexed, over the papers spread out across their coffee table. The notes, the faces, the bodies with the marks on them, the other bodies with deformities, though none as bad as Owen's.
You think that our son was born the way he was because of something that happened in a previous lifetime? Is that what you think?
Can't you admit that it's likely? Or at least possible? He was pushing her hard, but he couldn't help it. He needed this. She frowned pensively.
You've always been a sane man, Jerry. A cautious man. It doesn't seem to me that that has changed, even if...
She shook her head.
So, if you think it's possible, then I'll admit that it's possible. I'll give you that.
He grasped at her words. That's all I ask.
You're going to follow this anyway. Until you're done with it.
He met her gaze. I suppose that's true. She sighed, glancing at him sideways with a weary, humorous, reproachful look. It was as if she knew right then and there that he would never be done with it, that they would never have any more children, that she'd spend the rest of her days living in the wake of this obsession until there was nothing more to do but join it. And he was still at it. Wasn't he? Despite his compromised capacities, he was going forward. And now he was throwing protocol to the winds. The woman, the one whose name now eluded him, had insisted upon it. She had answered the door of her motel room instantly after his hesitant knock. She was wearing the clothes from the day before, and her face looked ashen in the morning light.
We had a bad night, she said flatly.
He'd handed her the pages he'd printed out in the motel's office, filled with the research he'd gathered, research that indicated a missing child named Tommy Crawford, who lived on Asheville Road.
You've got to be kidding me,
she said when she realized what he was giving her. But she took the papers and looked at them while Noah slept soundly in the next bed.
You think this is the previous personality,
she said at last. I do.
She kept picking up the pages and putting them down again. It's not unheard of for people to reincarnate into a different race or culture. Anderson spoke in a low voice. He tried to keep his urgency in check. There have been numerous cases in which Children in India remembered lifetimes spent in a different caste, and some Burmese children have seemed to remember previous lives as Japanese soldiers who were killed in Burma during World War II.
So, if we do this...
She gave him a sober, warning look.
If we do go to Ohio...
His heart leaped. He couldn't help it.
Yes?
We go now. Today.
That's not how it works, Anderson had said reasonably.
We email the family first, or write a letter, if we can. We don't just show up on their doorstep.
He had done this, as a matter of fact, in Asia, when the previous personality's family had no phone or method of contact. But in Asia, the families were not like American families, and more likely than not, they were at least curious to see him.
That's exactly what we are doing, she had said. I'm not going to approach some other grieving mother without being sure. Not again. If Noah doesn't recognize anything, we turn around and go home, and they are none the wiser.
His calm began to dissipate into the air. She couldn't be serious.
It's better to contact the family first.
I'm going, with or without you. I'm going to take the next flight out.
It's ill-advised.
Then so be it. I am not going to take Noah home only to start this all up again. So I guess it's now or never. And if we do this, she sat up straight on the bed. You can't write about it. You understand? This is about my son, not your legacy.
He had tried to smile. He was so tired.
Fuck my legacy.
His legacy. Oh, he had had high hopes for himself, but he hadn't gotten very far. There were so many things he still didn't know. Why were some children born with memories of past lives, their bodies marked with the imprints of past traumas? Was it related? It had to be, to the fact that 70% of the previous personalities these children remembered had died traumatic deaths? If consciousness survived death, and he had shown that it did, then how did this connect with what Max Planck and the quantum physicists realized? That events didn't occur unless they were observed, and therefore that consciousness was fundamental and matter itself was derived from it. Did that therefore make this world like a dream, with each life, like each dream, flowing one after the other? And was it then possible that some of us, like these children, were awakened too abruptly from these dreams and ached to return to them? The blue sky through the window spread out before him, on and on. So many things he'd longed to explore further. He'd wanted to plumb the very nature of reality. He'd wanted to finish this book. But now his mind was shattered, and all he wanted was to help a single child. He looked at the boy slumped against him, his body nestled on Anderson's arm. He could have been any child, sweetly sleeping. He was any child.
He likes you, the woman said.
And I like Tommy. Very much.
She drew in her breath sharply.
Noah.
What?
His name is Noah.
Of course. I'm so sorry. I don't know how that happened. Jerry, pull it together.
She had turned pale.
I'm sorry. I'm a little tired.
It's all right, she said.
But she looked away from him and bit her lip. Noah. Tommy. Everything came down to names, didn't it? The evidence that one was this person and not that one. And if they got lost, the names, when they got lost, and all you had left was one long, blurry stretch of humanity, like a bank of clouds in the sky, what then? He'd have to do better. He'd have to keep the names close. Noah. Tommy. He'd roll them up and fill the cracks in his mind with them, the way people tucked scraps of paper wishes between the stones of the wailing wall. They looked together at the sleeping boy.
You know I can't promise anything, Anderson murmured.
Of course.
She was lying, though. She thought he had promised her everything.
Chapter 22. Denise perched at the end of her chair and surveyed the bowl of M&Ms that always seemed untouched on the doctor's side table. Did anyone ever eat them? Were these the same M&Ms she'd been staring at for almost 7 years? Someone, she thought, should do an experiment. Put all the green ones on top and see what happens. Bust the good doctor cold. Denise, I'm listening. She didn't feel like looking at him, but decided he'd probably make a note of it if she didn't. His elegant, horsey face seemed even more elongated in worry. I said, everybody regresses sometimes, Dr. Ferguson was saying. It happens. She looked back at the M&M's bowl. Not to me. You're too hard on yourself. You've done incredible work creating a life for yourself. Don't forget that. A life for myself. She said it the way she might say, a half pound of salami, sliced thin, please. Or, time for your meds, Mr. Randolph. But what she meant, which anyone could see if he was not a fool, was, my life is shit. Dr. Ferguson was not a fool. She felt him regarding her. You're disappointed in yourself. She popped a green M&M in her mouth. The sugar turned to dust on her tongue. She couldn't taste a thing. I'm done. And what does that mean? She might as well tell him the truth. Who else could she tell? I'm done with it. I worked so hard all these years to pull it together for Charlie, and one phone call puts me right back there. And it's as if it all happened yesterday, and I can't... She took a breath. I can't do it. She felt him choosing his words cautiously. I understand. It must be extremely upsetting to feel that way again. She shook her head. I can't. He crossed one long, skinny leg over the other. And what other choice do you have? His Adam's apple bobbed visibly in his neck, like Ichabod Crane's in a movie she'd once seen. I guess this makes me the headless horseman, she thought. About right, too. She had no thoughts or feelings left. She was watching herself from a great height, the way the recent dead are said to watch their own bodies. Let's just say I'm considering my options. Are you telling me you're thinking of suicide? She took note of his concern. It was like a thought bubble hovering over his head, meaning nothing. She shrugged, a habit of Charlie's that always aggravated her, but she saw its usefulness now. Because if that's what you mean, if you're serious, I have to take some action. You know that. That hospital. Those stained sofas, chipped floors, vacant faces watching mindless television. She shuddered. Anyway, he would never give her a prescription if she seemed suicidal, and she needed the prescription. She didn't know why she had said it. You know I would never do that. Never. I would never give him the satisfaction. Him? She gave the doctor a withering look. The man who stole Tommy, of course. The minute she said it, she knew it was the truth. But she couldn't do it, damn it to hell. And she'd been feeling so calm, too. And, of course, I couldn't do that to Charlie. Of course she couldn't. And wasn't there some tiny part of her that still wanted something from this life? To cast these fragments of herself to the winds to see if they could take root somewhere? So, what did Detective Ludden say when you called him? You mean last night or this morning? All right, Doctor, now you see where we're at, do you not? A pause. Either one. He said that the detectives in Florida were working hard on the case. That's what he always says. They're working hard, ma'am. So polite, you know. And I know he thinks I'm crazy. All of them do. Who is all of them? Everybody. You think I'm paranoid? I'm not paranoid. Every time I run into people, they give me this look. Even now, it's subtle, but I see it. As if they're surprised, as if... As if what? As if something's wrong with me, and I shouldn't still be walking around. I should be... Yes? Dead, because Tommy's dead. It was the first time she'd said it. And she wanted immediately to take it back. The words had fallen out of her mouth like marbles rolling this way and that across the floor, irretrievable. And people were right, she thought. Why should she keep breathing? All these years she'd kept it together not only for Charlie but also for Tommy, so that she would be intact when he came back to her. But she couldn't pretend any longer. Tommy was dead, and she was a... What? Not a widow, not an orphan. There was no word for what she was. I see, Dr. Ferguson said. He slid the tissue box closer to her across the side table. They looked at each other. He was waiting, she realized, for her to cry. The square box gazed at her expectantly, its cardboard skin swimming with absurd pink and green bubbles, one tissue protruding obscenely from its slit, calling out for her tears, for her... What did the books call it? Catharsis. He wanted to see her break at last. Well, damned if he was going to get her to do that. What did it get you, catharsis? You still had to pick yourself up and go on with your life that was a pile of shit. She stood. Where are you going? Look, are you going to give me the prescription or not? It's not advisable. Yes or no? 'Cause I'll go elsewhere. You know someone else will give it to me if you don't. He hesitated, but he gave her the slip of paper. Come back soon, all right? Next week? You still had to pick yourself up and walk out that door and face the glare of the afternoon sun on the windshields of the cars in the parking lot. You still had to find your car and put your key in the ignition and hear its full-throated cry as it came to life. You had to steer it onto the road with all the other living, moving things, all headed somewhere or other, as if the rotation of the world depended on their trips to the dry cleaners or the mall. You had to pull off the road into the parking lot of the CVS and get out of the car and stand waiting at the counter with all the other people seeking the potions that would buy them another hour or another day, whether they wanted it or not. And you had to put half a pill in your mouth, just half, and swallow it, hard and dry, feeling it scrape down your throat. And then, since you had no food in the house and you had a human being besides yourself to look after, you had to walk down the sidewalk to the Stop and Shop. You had to stand there inside blinking under those bright, bright lights, all those rows and colors leaping out at you, tomatoes so red they hurt your eyes, fiery orange bags of Doritos, neon green six-packs of 7-Up, everything chirping out to the living, pick me, pick me, pick me. And you couldn't stand there forever. As if you'd never seen a supermarket before. You needed, even then, especially then, when your momentum began to flag, to keep moving. You filled your cart with what your family needed. You put a dead, skinned chicken in there, and a big box of cornflakes and a gallon of milk. You put broccoli in there for Charlie, the only vegetable he'd eat, and some Vidalia onions for Henry in case he came over someday. And you also put in a bag of grape tomatoes. You knew that Charlie wouldn't eat them, and you yourself preferred beefsteak, but you grabbed them anyway, didn't you? Their smooth red skins peeking out at you through the mesh of the bag. Grabbed them because Tommy liked them. Liked to hold them in his teeth and squirt them across the room, and you wanted to show yourself that you still remembered what Tommy liked, even if it did blast a hole in your heart. Then you had to stand in line ignoring Mrs. Manzanotti staring at you from the dairy section. So, You paged through the magazines filled with celebrities falling apart or falling in love or both, noticing that Mrs. Manzanotti was walking in your direction now and hoping that she still ignored you as she did the first few years, avoiding eye contact, flinching when you passed her in the market or downtown. But here she was, filled with determined good cheer, barreling towards you, as if all that was over with. And we must go on as before, mustn't we? It doesn't matter if you're ready. You got ready, fast. So you talked about how nice it was that it was finally feeling like spring today, as if you'd even noticed. And you asked after Mr. Manzanotti and Ethan and Carol Ann, and when she said, "And how's Charlie doing?" you said, "We're just fine, thank you," as if your own story were an article in a magazine someone could flip through and put back in the rack. As if your sweet boy wasn't... say it? Somewhere in pieces under the dirt. And while you paid the cashier, at that moment, it occurs to you that there's a man in Florida stopping at a gas station somewhere right this minute. You can see him clear as day buying a big bag of Doritos and beef jerky and a Red Bull, then leaving the bag there on the counter with the clerk as he heads to the toilet to pee before he gets back on the road. And the eyes of that man standing there, those unrepentant eyes staring in the bathroom mirror, they were the last eyes Tommy ever saw before. No. No, because Tommy was alive. Alive on this earth right now, in all his Tommy-ness, his love of tomatoes and marshmallows and butterscotch, his inexplicable hatred of strawberries, the way he'd grab her hand as she was leaving his bedside at night, asking her to stay for a few more minutes. Oh, why had she loosened herself from his grip and kissed him goodnight? Why hadn't she stayed for the few minutes he had craved? The dimple in his cheek that came out when he gave that foolish and duplicitous grin after some piece of naughtiness. Like that time he popped his brother's balloon on the way home from the carnival and pretended it was an accident. Tommy was alive on this earth, and no one could tell her otherwise. Tommy was alive on this earth. And someday they would see each other again. It happened sometimes. That girl out in Utah, for instance. The one with the friendly open face and the yellow hair, who looked like she had stepped out of the goat stall at the 4-H instead of crawling on her hands and knees up from purgatory. There she was, on the cover of the magazine. Denise still had that copy in the drawer of her bedside table. She knew it by heart. The girl had disappeared from her bedroom one night, and then 5 years later, she was home again, and the monster who did it was going to jail for forever and a day. There were the pictures of her with her family, sitting on the couch with her mother's arm wrapped around her, her father's hand resting on her shoulder as naturally as you please. She was starting up school again. That's what the article said, playing piano. A shy smile on her face, blue ribbons in her hair. The girl was intact. More or less. It could happen. Things happened. It wasn't any more or less unlikely than a child going for a bike ride to his best friend's house down the road one Saturday morning and falling off the edge of the earth. But these thoughts, like the magazine's pages, were almost worn through from too much use. Which made her go back to the other thought, which made her think again that she couldn't do it anymore. I can't hold on to hope, and I can't hold on without it either, she thought. She pulled out of the parking lot. When she reached the intersection, instead of heading right toward home, she took a left and found herself driving out toward Dayton. She drove for a while past the even green fields, unsure as yet as to where she was going, until she saw the sign for the new Staples out beyond the mall. It was shining its big neon smile at her, as if it had been waiting for her, as if she was one of the devout who had found her way back home. She felt a dim thrill when no one looked at her twice as she walked in the door. They kept doing what they were doing, a whole lot of nothing as far as she could tell. A girl with horrible fraying braids was paging through a magazine. A white boy with a knit cap on his head. Why did they wear that indoors? Unless they were bald, which this boy wasn't, was ringing something up. She heard his nervous scales of laughter echoing through the store. She wandered for a while down the long aisles, filled with dangling supplies, each with its own clear sense of purpose, soaking in the chilled air. In aisle 10, she picked up a new gleaming staple gun and walked to the back where the copy center was, feeling its heft in her hand. There was a line of people, clutching their papers, selling cars maybe, or looking for piano students. She stood online, another person with the need to multiply her longing exponentially, holding in her other hand the flyer she kept in the glove compartment for this very reason. She waited her turn, and then she handed her flyer to a boy in his early 20s. A boy with deep brown skin and a smooth, amiable, bored face. Maybe Tommy will look like that someday, she thought. Maybe Tommy will get a job at Staples. He could do worse for himself. She was letting herself think it. She knew that. It was as if her conscious mind was still back in the parking lot of the Stop and Shop, and she was letting this other part of herself take over again. 200, please. He took the paper from her and didn't look at it. Bless you, she thought. Bless you for not looking. The people in the stationery store in town had gotten used to her by now. The pity in their eyes was no longer fresh, but had congealed over the years into something familiar, automatic, as if Denise were a stray mutt that wandered in every now and then for a crust of bread or a pat. But Denise didn't need a pat or any rewarmed pity. She needed her 200 copies. Would you like that in different colors, ma'am, or on white paper? The face will be legible in different colors? Sure, we can do that. Then maybe different colors this time. All right, which colors would you like? You choose. I'll do yellow and green and red. How's that? Great. She smiled at him. She stood behind the counter, feeling its hard, sharp edge with her fingers. The feel of the pill gliding through her system, the staple gun heavy in her other hand. Henry had gotten rid of the other one. $29 it had cost her, and he'd thrown it right in the trash. "You've got to stop with the flyers," he had said. The words flowed through her mind as coolly as the frigid air, as if they were words she was overhearing spoken between strangers. What right do you have to show up here and tell me what to do? Charlie told me, that's what. Our son, he says you aren't even there for dinner half the time. The boy eats. Look at him. He's not starving. That's not the point. You are wearing yourself down, and Charlie too, and me too. What do you care? You have to stop, please. I can't. What if... Call the doctor, then. Get some help. What if it makes a difference, Henry? What if someone sees one of them and, for God's sakes, Denise? The boy was back. Actually, the red's a little dark for a face. How about blue? The blue's real light. That'd be fine. She waited. She had only to wait, her hands fingering the sharp edge of the countertop. Tommy's face multiplying in green and blue and yellow. She let her mind linger on each of the faces as they poured out of the machine, thinking maybe this one. Maybe this will be the one that makes all the difference.
Chapter 23. Charlie Crawford rode his bike home slowly from Harrison Johnson's house, his head percolating with riffs. His whole body pulsating with the thrill of victory
and the first-class weed Harrison always had on hand from his brother's friend who worked at the pizza place. Ba-da-da, ba-da-da-da. The way he'd extended that last beat, rolling it and then holding it so it had resonated around the garage, he'd known right away he hadn't fucked it up. He could see it in the way Harrison and Carson really stopped and listened for fucking once, in the grudging nods they aimed in his direction as he headed out the door at the end of rehearsal. He knew they'd been wanting to ditch him for that Mike kid at the community college. They never thought he was good enough. He'd always been the kid with a drum kit who lived nearby and could kinda sorta hold a beat. But today, he'd shown them but good. He'd killed that fucker, left it lying dead in the road. Okay, so maybe it wasn't the best drum solo ever of all time. Maybe he wasn't like Lars Ulrich. But in his life, this is what amounted to a major fucking victory, and he was going to take that baby and ride it all the way home. The amazing Harrison's brother's friend's weed flowing through him, making everything all right. Making everything so very, very all right that he did an extra loop around the block, down past the neighbor's vicious dog to the edge of the cornfields and back again, and didn't even particularly dread sailing back into his own driveway, where thanks be to God his mother's car was out. Could it get any better? He could grab a carton of ice cream and go upstairs to his room and text Gretchen, or, even better, think about Gretchen without having the stress of actually texting her, lying there on his bed while the high was still in him, thinking about Gretchen's breasts jiggling to the beat of his killing drum solo, her knees swaying open and shut in that jeans miniskirt she'd worn to school day before yesterday. Or wait, even better, skip Gretchen entirely, too much work, and get right to it on the internet. Ready, set, go. Now that was a pleasant way to spend an afternoon. He swung back down the block again, tingling with anticipation, his dreads flying like wings above his ears, then decided he'd better get on with it before the high faded. He never risked bringing any pot home. For one thing, his mom was all up in his ass about that shit, and for all he knew would ship him out to a military academy if she found so much as a bud in his pocket, which was hard, actually, to keep on top of. To keep one's head in the game like that about every stray bud when you got stoned as often as he did. So far, though, she'd merely sniffed at him a few times after he came home, as though he were a rancid meatloaf in the fridge. She probably didn't know what the stuff smelled like, thought he had some funky-ass sweat. Luckily, no one messed with his locker at school. He could have a drugstore in that thing, and no one would be the wiser. He dropped his bike in the yard and ran to the door. But there were people walking around the house, looking around. White people. A man and a woman and a little kid, too. Uh-oh. Maybe some Jehovah's Witnesses, though most of the Jehovah's he'd seen around there had been black. He didn't even know there were white Jehovah's. Did Mormons come this far out? Got to hand it to them bringing the kid along. That was a nice touch. Hard to slam a door on a kid. Funny little kid, too. He was hopping up and down like he was pretending to be a kangaroo, yelling, "This is it! This is it! This is it!" He kept patting the aluminum siding as if the whole house were a big red dog.
"Can I help you?"
Charlie said. Summoning up his best, "This fine young man was raised right," grin, which he could beam right through his stoner's haze. His specialty, actually. He could be sitting in the office of Principal Ranzetta herself right now, and she'd have nary a clue, and had done so, in point of fact. The three of them gaped at him. The woman spoke up at last.
"Is Mr. or Mrs. Crawford at home?"
Boy, they sure did their homework, these evangelical types.
"Mom isn't here right now. Maybe come back another time?"
He looked up at them, hopefully. The lady and the old guy glanced at each other. They looked like they were having a disagreement without saying anything. Like the woman had an agenda, and the old guy wanted out of there. Were they from the school? He didn't recognize them, but the old guy did have a school superintendent-y kind of vibe, and the woman could be an administrator, or maybe even a cop. She had that wired-up look. Maybe they'd found the pot in his locker, and she was going to lock him up or throw him out or send him to rehab like that lame ass in social studies who got caught with a bottle of peppermint schnapps in his desk. I mean, schnapps? That's what you get busted for? In your desk? Schnapps? But why'd they...